F2A. Number 9A.
I just want to finish the horizontal here in the same atmosphere. He shows now if there is something else you have to prove. Not only like in James that you have to prove your faith by his works, or in Peter that it says you have to prove to me that in no circumstances you are wavering, that even suffering doesn't make you waver in it, that because you know that either suffering or science will bring you forward. So another point has to be proved, namely Christianity. I come to the three letters of John, which says you also have to prove to me that you accept and have accepted really in your life that your life is a calculus, a divine infinite calculus. But that what constitutes man, the perfect man, is actually Christ translating itself as a calculus of idea into your everyday life. You see, at that time when John was writing, the doctrine, the false doctrine, was prevalent, that Christ has nothing to do with the human, that Christ has nothing to do with the flesh. Whereas we know that the Christ, in the definition of the Christ, is a divine manifestation that comes to the flesh to destroy incarnate error. So they said the Christ has nothing to do with the human, and that was a doctrine of Docetism, I think I pronounced it right, Docetism, which says the Christ cannot be translated to the point of man, to the human. And so John came and showed in a universal sense, in a collective sense, an individual sense, that really the Christ translates itself through a calculus of ideas to everyone, to every situation, to the flesh. So that man is not just an abstract idea, but that man is something that works in being and in spite of the flesh, and that you can prove the Christ in the flesh. That was the letters of John. And he showed it and said, I give you that calculus, how you can prove it, namely through the calculus of the Word, where he said, if you walk in the way of life, then the Christ translates itself to the flesh, then in Christianity you will see that then the Spirit of the Christ dwells in man and takes room in man, so that within you you feel the Savior, and that takes care of every material situation, so that understanding will solve, as a force, that understanding will solve every human, material, fleshly problem. So he's quite a guy, that John there, how he says in those three letters, and that is a universal fact in the first letter, that is a fact for every collective group like the church, and that is a fact for every individual like the problem that Gaius had. So he shows really that we can prove the Christ, man, in the flesh, in spite of the flesh, but in the flesh, that it is translatable right down to the material level, so that there is no more a dualistic sense there about man. And then he goes further and comes to the last one, to Jude. And you know how Jude, he is the one that finally gives you in a short epistle really the distinction what makes up an ungodly man, what makes up a godly man. And he said the one that is a godly man is the man that has faith in the new doctrine and lives according to the new doctrine. And what will be the result of it? God keeps him from falling. He can no more fall. So if we have accepted the signs of being, we know that then we can no more become sick, that there we can no more sin, and in there we can no more die. Man cannot become sick, man cannot sin, and man cannot die. That's what Jude was seeing in a very short epistle, so that he can prove something very big, namely that God keeps men from falling. There is no fallen man anymore. Yeah. That's the fourth horizontal. So we make a break here, and we go on afterwards. Well, we have done quite a bit up to now. And what have we done? See, instead of reading from beginning to end the text of the epistles, we have done the very opposite. We have first defined to us the frame of reference within which the epistles are written. So as to say that we go out from the whole and try to see what is the inner structure of the whole. So in order to describe the frame of reference, we use the method of a matrix. And a matrix can show two indices. It is only two-dimensional. We cannot present it in more than two dimensions in writing. But that is quite sufficient, because Paul himself, he was trying actually to show the whole subject of Christianity from the point of view of two levels, namely from the point of view of absolute Christian Science and of Christian Science, so that we were touching upon a category of being, one of the main categories of being, the levels. Within that category of the levels, we were considering then the verticals and the horizontals, namely a second category of being, the fourfold operation. So we had already taken into account really the category of the levels and the category of the calculus, of the fourfold calculus, and we are trying to calculate the place value of every message, of every epistle, through that frame of reference. Can you see what we mean by calculating? We can see that nothing happens outside the infinite one, and the infinite one can be represented through the chart, that is, can be represented through the three main categories. Therefore, no problem exists outside really the one being. No problem exists really outside the three main categories. So if we have a tonality of the categories, then we include always the whole world, and therefore the answer to everything in the world. Can you see how we approach the subject? It's the other method than was usually used up to now in every science, namely to take each element and each incident, each experience, and try to put them together in some way, in some shape or form, and in this way had to speculate a lot on what it means, that relationship. And it was a burden, because there are innumerable situations, innumerable factors in being, innumerable truths in being. And so that is seen as being a very insufficient method. The more sufficient method is the other way around, to go out from the whole and little by little narrow down each point of intersection. That we have done. So we have been able, through two categories up to now, namely the level category and the fourfold category, to define 16 points of intersections, the 4x4, and in this way define what spiritually must happen within that point of intersection, or at that point of intersection. And in this way we got an overall view of all the epistles. Now, we can go further and bring in another category so as to explain still in more detail what is happening within that matrix. We can bring in really a third category, and that is the seven synonymous terms. Up to now, we hardly have spoken of the seven synonymous terms. We are constantly calculating within levels and the fourfold operation. Now we know that each epistle has a layout, has a structure within itself. For instance, we have seen, and that's the only time we mentioned the seven synonymous terms, we have seen that Romans is laid out through the Christ order of the seven synonymous terms. So at that point, we took in a third main category, namely the seven. In this way, we can bring out always more precisely, more clearly, what is happening at the point of intersection. So if we bring in now in the text, and it is in the text, the sevenfold nature of God, either as world order or Christ order or Christianity or science order, we bring in the third category of the seven. And in this way we combine all three main categories within one matrix. Still the one same matrix. What does it do to us? Well, the moment we bring in the seven, we know that we bring in more detail. A greater detail, a finer structuring of the subject, and therefore more insight into the subject. So let's, for an hour or so, see how Paul has done that and how in my epistle book I tried to bring that out. We take, for instance, Romans, and you have your epistle book, and perhaps you take the epistle book and open it at page 59. So there on the lower part of that page, there is a summary, and then in the next paragraph we get that summary of what is in Romans. Translated from the biblical terminology into metaphysical terminology, into more modern terminology of abstract ideas, no more so much in biblical symbolism. And so what we have here is therefore a epitomizing of the story that Paul tells to the Romans. But as I say, translated already into modern language. So we can say that that point of intersection which we had, which was showing that God, the grace of God, wants to bring out what we said, the vertical wants to bring out the man in his image and likeness. So that must always be the story in it, that what is brought out, that man reflects, so to say, God, and he gets that as a gift of grace. And so he presents first in Roman that translation from God to man and shows how it is possible that through the grace of God, through the Christ translation, is brought out the true idea man. And we take quickly this summary and consider it, what it says. We have first principle there. Through faith in God, we know that we are always righteous before God. That fundamentally, we are the sanctified of God. Can you see first principle here? He talks in that part of principle a lot about the righteousness of God, and that before God we always find our righteousness, that we are sanctified before God, and gives us that sense of principle, that righteousness of principle, that principle only is always righteous, is always the right, gives the right judgment. And so we start out, well, God is the righteousness of God, and therefore, fundamentally, man is also righteous before God. He's sanctified before God. So you can see the relationship between God and man, first through principle, as a principled idea. Why is he sanctified before God? Why is he righteous before God? Life tells us that. So in the second subject of life, he tells us the reason. Namely, that through faith in God, we attain this divine righteousness as an act of grace and not for personal merit. Here he brings in now his new doctrine that because God is always righteous, therefore is that which manifests itself as life, that he gives everything without really a personal merit for it. It's that grace of God that comes to everybody and to everyone, not asking, do you merit such a treatment or don't you merit such a treatment? Grace is that which does not ask after personal merits, but says, I'm here and I pour out my riches to everybody and to every situation in an unlimited way. This is very different from the works of the law. So he tells that story. It's a wonderful story when you read it and you see how he goes back to Abraham and showed how Abraham had really that promise and was living by that promise, and he got it through faith in grace. Then we come to the subject of truth, which says, well, through that faith in God, see, it's always faith in God, it's not faith in Christ, it's faith in God because we are in the first vertical. Through that faith in God, we receive through grace the inheritance of God, and therefore the spirit of adoption. Now we are adopted. He begins to see that we are the Son of God. We are adopted by God. You get the sense of truth, the true man. Always, can you see, always explaining the relationship of God to man. That must always be in it, because the Christ translation is that which translates God to man and shows why it is possible that God that comes to man can come to the flesh and to the incarnate error and bring out, in spite of the flesh, in spite of incarnate error, the true man as the image and likeness of God. So here he becomes really the Son of God because he has the spirit of adoption. Then Paul goes further to a completely different subject and shows really the plan of love, of salvation. Namely, that through faith in God, each one has within himself the seed of the promise. So not only Abraham had that seed of promise within himself, but everyone, he would here bring out, has that seed in himself. He gives the sense that this is a universal fact, a universal idea, and that as children of the faith, we take part, really, in that plan of salvation. That there is always a remnant in each one. At that point, he speaks about the remnant. That nobody is so bad and is such a sinner that there is not the seed in himself which can be planted and which will grow and grow stronger and stronger until it grows over the rampart, until it goes really is overflowing everything. So, did I read that already? No. Through faith in God, each one has within himself the seed of that promise. None can therefore escape salvation. You get the universal sense that every man, that love comes to everyone. Again, the relationship of God to man. It comes to everyone, no matter if he's bond or free, no matter if he's a Gentile or a Jew, that all will be saved. No one can escape it. It may first come to the Gentiles and afterwards to the Jew. though the promise was first to the Jew and then to the Gentiles, it can come also the other way around. It can come first to the Gentiles and then to the Jews. But everybody will have to be saved and will be saved. You can't escape that. Terrific sense of the universality of love. Then we know that in the Christ translation that after love you get another block, so it is always that principle, life, truth, and love forms the first block in that translation. Then soul, spirit, mind is of a completely different nature, is a second block, which then shows how that is translated to the human in spite of the human. So he shows then in soul that through faith in God, all our interests are changed and reformed. Now you can see it comes to the human and begins to overturn and overturn and overturn. Now the human is touched, the wrong man is touched, the sinner is touched. And it says, but soul comes always in its same nature, in its identical nature to every situation, even to the sinner. But what does it do there? It shows that it changes man, reforms man, and that he resurrects man. So that is why the Christ comes to the flesh and does something in the flesh. Then he takes up another subject of spirit, which we epitomize as through faith in God, our faith becomes even stronger. So that translation from God to man comes to us and does something in us. It strengthens our faith in that Christ idea, in that Christ translation, so that we get stronger and stronger in our faith. Then finally, we have mind, which says, through faith in God, the strength of faith impels us now to become doers of faith. So that strength of spirit translates itself further in man, and we are shaken out of our apathy and are called to act boldly, and we become doers of the word. And in this way, that God is reflected now in man, so that man does that what God does too. And so there is a complete agreement between God and man through the Christ translation. That is what he can show here. It's a wonderful order, that Christ order, and I just want to go through it again, because it seems that the students have trained themselves very much in the word order, but very little in the other orders. Usually the Christ order is already a bit foreign to them. With the Christianity order, they don't know quite what to do with it. And when they come to the science order, they rather like to shun it than to investigate it. So, naturally, the word order is fundamental, and it's right that one is versed in that word order. But I always feel that's a pity that we are not consciously aware of the Christ order. Especially as we have said this week should really bring out that the order of the calculus is from the Word to the Christ and only then to Christianity, and not from the Word to Christianity. And this is only because we have not consciously cultured that consciousness of God coming to man, and that is the only operative power that operates in being, and operates in us, that we have that Christ spirit within us too. And so I would like you to take heed of this, or to remember perhaps during the year that you also take some time of pondering, of being very quiet within you, and just ponder that terrific Niagara fall that comes down, that waterfall comes down with all its might, with all its power from above, and nothing can resist it. I have never seen anybody going up the Niagara Falls. They always come down. And that is the Christ attitude. That Christ attitude, as I have said, has, so to say, two blocks in the development, in the flow. The first block is principle, life, truth, and love. With principle, life, truth, and love, first is established that the divine principle really is that which is bringing forth really the impulsion of life, the consciousness of truth, and the plane of love. It shows what the idea of principle wants to accomplish as an ideal. So the ideal is life, truth, and love. Then it wants to show that ideal is an ideal that translates itself in an ideal way to the point of every single idea, to every single situation. And in order to do that, the Christ translation needs the second block of soul, spirit, and mind in order to bring out in every situation the image of God at the point of mind, the manifestation of God at the point of idea, that every idea of mind manifests the whole of God. So let's just consider that Christ translation again, but I see that we have to change our tapes or I'm interrupted in the flow.